McGill Daily of the Daily.
I'm McGill Daily.
Hi, I'm calling from the McGill Daily. Can I ask you some questions?
This is a little bit diplomatic.
News. Can you design?
Could I see you for a second?
We're gonna cap this.
News, can you dummy?
Did that story come in yet?
Editorial's in 5 minutes.
McGill Daily.
I'm fit to pray.
You are listening to Unfit to Print, a McGill Daily and CKUT news collaboration. I'm Alice Dutrue. Unfit to Print is a student-produced bi-weekly show that brings the latest in McGill and Montreal news. On today's program, you'll hear a feature conversation with Malise Kagan, who is a queer feminist who is currently studying Middle Eastern studies and anthropology, and Ralph Haddad, who is also a queer feminist who is studying World Islamic and Middle East studies, as well as women's studies. Tomorrow, they will be facilitating a workshop entitled Palestine is a Queer Issue, a workshop on Israeli pinkwashing and homo-nationalism, which is held in conjunction with Israeli Apartheid Week, Montreal. We'll also bring you an update about McGill's mental health working group. But first, headlines. Here are some of the headlines of McGill News over the past 2 weeks. Physics PhD student Yoni Bressler will be the interim Secretary General of the Postgraduate Student Society for the remainder of the academic year. The announcement was made on February 24th, and according to preliminary results, Bressler was elected with 541 votes, or 55.5%. February 23rd, the Student Society of McGill University and Postgraduate Student Society met to discuss student priorities in McGill University's upcoming budget planning and counteracting provincial austerity measures. This was the first time that the two associations have held a joint meeting of this type. While counselors from both associations voted at the same time, motions required a separate two-thirds majority within both the Student Society and the Postgraduate Student Society to pass. The Student Society of McGill University is holding its Winter General Assembly on Sunday, March 15th. The General Assemblies happen once a term, and students from the Society can bring up items 2 weeks before the Assembly. The motions that have been brought forward this Assembly are a motion regarding divestment from companies profiting from the illegal occupation of the Palestinian territories, a motion regarding policy on accessible education, a motion regarding unpaid internships, and a motion to stand in solidarity with students and protesters demanding democratic government worldwide. The campaign period for the Student Society of McGill University's executive elections, taking place on March 18th to 20th, began on Monday. This year, three positions have only one candidate running: VP Finance and Operations, VP Clubs and Services, and VP University Affairs. There is also no one running for the VP External position, meaning by-elections will have to be held in April to find someone to hold the position. Candidates will be facing off in press debates on Thursday and the Student Society of McGill debates next Tuesday. For more in-depth coverage of these stories or other news articles, go to our website at mcgilldaily.com or pick up a print copy of our paper on stands now. This is Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. Tomorrow, on March 10th, Malise Kagan and former McGill Daily editor Ralph Haddad, from McGill Students in Solidarity with Palestinian Human Rights, will be hosting a workshop on Israeli pinkwashing and homo-nationalism. This workshop will be discussing an important topic that currently affects the lives of many queer Palestinians. The Daily's Anya Sivajothi brings us this interview.
I'm currently sitting here with Malise Kagan and Ralph Haddad, who are the presenters for a workshop entitled Palestine is a Queer Issue, a workshop on Israeli pinkwashing and homo-nationalism, which will be held tomorrow at the SMU building. This workshop is a part of Israeli Apartheid Week Montreal, which is also holding other events such as film screenings, art exhibitions, and other workshops. It started on March 8th and will continue until March 17th. Hi, thank you so much for joining us, and could you maybe start off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, my name is Melis Chan. I'm a queer feminist from Turkey.
My name is Ralph Haddad. I'm a queer feminist from Lebanon.
And what are your roles within this workshop?
We will be facilitating the workshop, and we also prepared the workshop.
So we organized this workshop as part of Israeli Apartheid Week.
Okay.
And it's one of many workshops happening across Montreal, notably at McGill and Concordia. And I think it's the only pinkwashing workshop of its kind this year. I know they had one last year, but it was mostly panel-based, and this one is student-based. So it's more discussion-based.
So what is the workshop about?
So we're going to be talking about pinkwashing and homonationalism in general, both in like a general as general concepts in North America and like around the world, but mostly focusing on Israel because it's a part of Israeli Apartheid Week.
Yeah, I guess pinkwashing is an important topic that people usually don't talk about with regards to the Israeli occupation of Palestine, because the occupation does affect not just the Palestinians, but also queer people within Palestine, women within Palestine, children within Palestine. So I feel like it's important to keep reminding people that aspect, and also how Israel's campaign of colonialism also takes the queer struggle and also the queer discourse and co-opts it to perpetuate an image of itself as the only bastion of human rights in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
A notable thing that Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the current prime minister of Israel, said at an American-Israel Public Affairs Committee conference 2 weeks ago. He said that, you know, within, like, among a dark, savage Middle East, Israel is the only beacon of human rights. And that does very much fit into what pinkwashing does, is not just to distract away from human rights abuses, but also to co-opt a queer struggle. So there's those, like, two discursive aspects of that.
Would you maybe explain what pinkwashing is, and specifically like Israeli pinkwashing?
Okay.
Yeah, pinkwashing is using queer rights and also women's rights to promote a sort of North American European liberalism and to appeal to North American and European liberals and kind of create a more positive image of Israel, which was kind of started in the early 2000s with the Brand Israel campaign, because Israel was doing really bad in polls about its image around Western countries, North America and Europe. And they decided to do this Brand Israel campaign to increase their image and appeal to liberals.
What's interesting about this campaign is that, as Meta said, it appeals to quote-unquote Western liberal idea of what values and democracies are. And that sort of puts the societies of Palestine and Israel on an equal footing, which is untrue and factually incorrect. Palestine is not a quote-unquote Western society, but Israel is. So to begin with, it's unfair to make that comparison with regards to queer rights, especially when Israeli officials say that Palestinians don't treat their queer people correctly. They don't have legalized gay marriage, for instance, just like Israel does. They don't have gay pride parades. They don't have very open sort of like I don't know, places where queer people can congregate, which I guess is factually incorrect as well. So within that, what Brand Israel does is it preaches these liberal democratic values back to Westerners, and sort of like Israel sells itself as, you know, we're just like you, Western country. And in that, it's not just preaching to sort of the general population of Western countries, but also to various lobbies. They give it financial support, so that's really mm-hmm. important to note. And, I mean, also the U.S. government, most notably, is Benjamin Netanyahu's speech in Congress last week, where he just, you know, just reiterated that whole, like, discourse of Israel being, you know, a great, like, facilitator of human rights in the Middle East, or, like, the only one or whatever.
Also essentializes all Israelis as very pro-gay and, like, essentializes all Palestinians as Muslim and homophobic, which is factually incorrect because there are a lot of homophobic incidents in Israel and also a lot of activists in, like, queer activists in Palestine who are trying to increase, improve the situation for queers in Palestine.
Exactly. What it does is basically erase any difference that exists within Palestinian society, but also within the Middle East as a whole. So when you talk about the Middle East, you don't just talk about one culture, you talk about various different cultures. And these different cultures do have their own ways of dealing with things based on their specific societies. So a country that does manifest itself as a Western country can't come compare itself to a country that doesn't identify itself as such and say, you're not doing this and this right. What Palestinian society does, and specifically Palestinian civil society and specifically queer activism and women's activism within that civil society, is it responds to the demands of society. So they assess what the situation is within Palestine regarding the queer discourse, for example, people's moods towards it, people's characteristics, the socioeconomic sort of aspect of that discourse, the way social relations are built up. And within that framework of Palestinian society, they then address the issue. And given that, you know, the way Western societies have dealt with the queer issue is maybe putting it within a legal framework. But what Palestinian civil society does is it puts it within a social civil society framework. So it starts from a very grassroots perspective approach to it, and sort of like builds that up, you know, taking, I guess, like from a Western perspective, a nonconformist way to queer issues, but that doesn't necessarily delegitimize the queer existence within Palestine.
Okay, thank you. In response to this event, there recently was a commentary that was written, and I was wondering if you guys can elaborate on some of the misconceptions that people have with regards to pinkwashing.
We just read this commentary this morning. And I was appalled at the language used in the piece, especially, I guess, as a self-identified Arab and queer person. For example, the author chose to say that queer rights are basically absent from the rest of the Middle East and exist in Israel. And the Middle East sort of has to catch up with Israel because Israel is this, you know, great country where everyone can live in equal harmony. And, you know, that is classic Orientalism that just manifests itself in different ways. That also, again, tends to erase queer activism that is very much, that does very much exist in the most unusual places like Saudi Arabia, for example. I know Lebanon and Palestine have sort of like the most organizational queer movements. They're more grounded, but they do exist all over the Middle East. Another thing the author said, well, I mean, like, this just goes back to our beliefs, but they chose to highlight Israel's, you know, its establishment based on
liberal democracy,
you know, respect for, like, all human lives, treating everyone equally, and its establishment, you know, it's a peaceful establishment, and its establishment based on the idea of just, like, equal civil liberties for all, which we know is factually incorrect to a large extent.
It was interesting that he used the word regardless of race in mm-hmm. there as well, which is just very untrue considering the whole apartheid system in Israel right now.
You know, you can't just say that about a country when a country is actively, as we speak right now, enforcing collective punishment on an entire people and also maintaining a very costly occupation and a very costly siege of, you know, two territories that are geographically apart but still share, you know, similar struggles. I guess, I mean, like, because within Israel there are over 50 laws that do discriminate people based on the fact that they're Palestinian or Arab in origin. Within the Knesset, for example, an Arab Knesset member was indicted for speaking out against the oppression, Israeli oppression of Gaza. But most recently, a member, Avigdor Lieberman, publicly called for the beheading of Palestinians based on difference. So I do not understand why people continue to say that Israel sort of operates within a sphere of equality when we know and, you know, history can support all these things that we're saying. We're not just saying these things. Is that Israel does not. There is a separation wall. There are segregated routes within the West Bank for settlers and Palestinians. Palestinian villages are denied water because water is taken away from the villages and sort of redirected towards the settlements. Land is taken away from villages and then settlements are built on the confiscated land. Houses are demolished every day in East Jerusalem, for example, to make way for more settlements. It's an apartheid system.
So with regards to the workshop, what are your goals or what do you hope to gain out of this workshop that you're hosting?
So we basically want to raise awareness on pinkwashing and how Israel uses queer rights to create this positive image, and also to raise awareness about the queer activism that goes on in grassroots in Palestine, and also to situate ourselves as allies within North America and see what we can do to keep raising awareness and about this issue.
Yeah, I guess I feel like, you know, not in our name is like, you know, a thing that's just like going on in the social media sphere right now, but honestly, like, not in our name. We don't want governments, specifically the U.S. and the Israeli governments, to campaign wars, foreign policy efforts, marketing campaigns, very neoliberal sort of strategies that take the queer struggle as an onus to further their own neoliberal and quote-unquote democratic goals. It speaks on behalf of the entire queer community, and that's unfair. It speaks over the entire queer community. It does not address their needs. It doesn't address whether they consent to this campaign to begin with. And this entire campaign operates within an anti-Arab, anti-Islamic sphere, which I guess is important to me personally, because without sort of the post 9/11 Islamophobia, pinkwashing would not necessarily exist in the way it does now. Because when people talk about queer demographics within Middle Eastern countries, they usually point out the oppressive nature of Arab or Islamic regimes and contributing to their to queer oppression, which also largely to a large extent factually incorrect, because they then disregard the role the British and French colonial powers had in enforcing anti-queer laws to begin with in these colonial states. So, yeah, I guess it's important to point out.
And when you were doing this workshop, who were the organizers that were involved, or what were the groups that were involved?
It was largely SPHR and McGill, but also all the other organizers of Israeli Apartheid Week, such as the QPIGs at McGill and Concordia, SPHR Concordia.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, beforehand, Midnight Kitchen is having a Palestine solidarity serving. So they're helping us in their own way, and that's great, because even Palestinian cuisine is to a large extent co-opted and appropriated by a lot of communities. So it's nice to just, like, bring that back and bring that discourse back and sort of educate people.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, that sounds great. So the workshop is happening tomorrow from 1:30 to 3 p.m., and it will be held in the Madeline Parent Room in the SMU building. And where should people go if they want to find out more information about the event?
Well, there's a Facebook event, but they can contact us directly to sphr.mcgill@gmail.com. That's our email. We also take inboxes from people on Facebook, on the McGill Students in Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights Facebook group. So people can message us there directly as well.
That was an interview with Malise Kagan and Ralph Haddad. You can learn more about the event by visiting their Facebook event called Palestine is a Queer Issue, a workshop on Israeli pinkwashing and homo-nationalism, or also visiting the Israeli Apartheid Week Montreal website at www.saimontreal.org. We turn now to an update about the McGill Mental Health Working Group. The Daily's Jesuit Corps spoke with Jenna Luker, the Executive Director of Student Services at McGill.
Last June, the Mental Health Working Group at McGill University submitted recommendations to the administration regarding proposed changes to the mental health services at McGill. Today, we have Jenna Luker, the Executive Director for Student Services here at McGill University, to tell us more about the implementation of these recommendations. Thanks, Jenna, for joining us here today.
No problem.
All right, so why was the Mental Health Working Group started? Was there a specific problem you saw, or was there an ongoing concern over the years at McGill?
I think that there's several reasons, actually, and it's not just McGill, but it's really we've seen it as a cross-Canada phenomenon of the rising rates of mental health challenges with students post-secondary. So that's sort of the general idea, and we knew this was increasing. The uptake of the services has been increasing, as I said, not just at McGill, but across Canada. So trying to look at a full review of what we're doing to ensure proper access. That was really what the motivation was. There were some secondary things as well. The waiting times were too long. We were looking at other kinds of issues, but they all tied into the rising, what I would say, almost crisis proportion and what the students need, and we try to support them. So that's generally speaking.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the specific problems that the group identified and how mental health issues are dealt with at McGill?
Well, there were several different areas, and you can go on the website to look specifically with the recommendations, and they tie into what some of the issues that were identified. Wait time certainly was an issue, but there was also an idea of how do we increase pan-university supports for mental health for all students, not just within student services, but across the university, with the understanding that this is a concern with the faculties, with the administration outside, everywhere at the university. But how do we train and develop more intentional supports right across in all divisions?
All right. And why do you think it's important to have strong mental health services at the university level?
I think that the whole idea of the services and to support students is to, for all students to be able to achieve the maximum of their potential. And we all know people or ourselves at different times in our life, we all need support, we need help. And I think that the university is at no different than any other stage in our life. In fact, you know, entering adulthood is often fraught with challenges, especially if people are living home, lots of changes. So to be able to support students in wherever their needs are.
Okay. And the Mental Health Working Group is made up of both staff and students, but the stakeholders who were specifically surveyed about what recommendations they thought should be implemented based on their experience with mental health constituted entirely of staff. Do you think there was an adequate representation of the student body?
I'm surprised. I looked at the list just yesterday and there were students on it. So we might want to revisit that, because certainly the stakeholders and the people on the committee need the input of students. And it may have been done in a different way. I'm not sure how it was represented, but there were definitely students made up a great deal of the input into the recommendations, because that's where the information is coming from. Also, obviously, the staff who see the students, because the focus is really student-centered. So even with, we're talking about staff or faculty, they were discussing the what they perceived as the mental health needs of the students. So I wanted just to make sure that has to be front and center, the student needs, because that's the only reason it exists, is for the students. So that's what the staff and faculty and students would all be coming together to discuss.
Okay. And what is the implementation process of the recommendations, and what is the progress so far?
Sure. Well, the progress will be able to be tracked easily on the website under Mental Health Working Group Recommendations, and we've developed a kind of a template from the recommendations themselves, broken them down into sort of more bite-sized pieces, and tried to delegate out to the units where it's most appropriate. So some of the recommendations already have timelines associated with them, some have already been achieved, but they're quite numerous, so to describe it in this short piece would be difficult for me, plus I don't remember them all, but anyone can go onto the site and look. The process was after the recommendations were received. That's how I broke it down into a template that would be transparent and visible to anybody who wanted to see it. And who and what units are responsible for the implementation of the recommendations. Some aren't perfectly clear yet, but they're very few. Most of them have very specific units as principal leaders on each project and secondary on each project, then timelines. Presently, we're just updating the February progress as far as percentage of recommendation completed, and then there'll be one in April, and I assume for next year it will continue, because some of these are really long term as well.
Right. And what is the ultimate goal for mental health services at McGill?
Mental health services at McGill, the ultimate goal would be to be part of a multidisciplinary action and a part of a pan-university development of culture, as I was saying before, of an increased mental health wellness. So they would be just one cog in the wheel of a larger supportive environment for the mental health of the students at McGill.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us here today.
No problem.
The Daily's Jesuit Corps spoke with Jana Luker, who's the Executive Director of Student Services at McGill. Well, that does it for this edition of Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. Thank you to Anya and Jasreet for their pieces this week. And make sure to tune in 2 Tuesdays from now to hear our next episode, and check out our past stories and podcasts, including culture and fiction pieces, at mcgilldaily.com/podcast.
Unfit to Print.